I came out of the UN and the UN kicked me out because I didn't want anyone to try to reform this institution, which is so much in need for reform.
The oil will be sort of phased out. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
After oil, we shall live from exactly the same we live from before and under oil. That's hard work and smart work. I'm working very closely with China.
They like to make money in China.
Welcome to the Arctic Podcast. We have our special guest today, an international climate optimist celebrity. He is the former chair of the OECD Development Assistance Committee in Paris. He was the Undersecretary General of the United Nations and an Executive Director of the United Nations Environmental Programme, 2016 to 2018. Before that, he was a member of the Norwegian Parliament from 1989 through 2001. He was a leader of the Socialist Left Party. I believe he's changed to another color now. He was a minister for international development and environment from 2005 through 2012. He's also an experienced global peace negotiator, having acted as the main facilitator of the peace process in Sri Lanka, 98 to 2005, and contributed to the peace process in Sudan, Nepal, Myanmar, Burundi. And as I mentioned, he is a bit of a Dr. Feel-Good pro-business climate man. So we are delighted to have you here in this Arctic Podcast studio, Erik Solheim.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting.
So I thought we should start with a little bit of Q&A, just to get to know you a little bit better. Fairly random questions. Now, the first, it's not really a question, but I was thinking about this the other day because I sometimes do color coding in my notes, and I... Obviously, I've been working too long, maybe, in the stock market. So in the stock market, color red means negative. It means going down. Color green generally means positive, going up. Erik, what do you think?
Well, my main political color at the moment is green. I think we could add a little bit of red and a little bit of blue. Blue meaning that we need business and we need a business-friendly environment. Red meaning that we also need government regulations and we need a fair transition into the green society.
But your favorite color is green.
Yeah.
What color did you choose for your latest Tesla?
I am a great admirer of Tesla. I mean, it's fantastic that Tesla is now have a bigger market value than the next car companies in the world combined. But we bought a Hyundai Kona last year. It makes 500 kilometers on one charge. And it's a fantastic car.
Oh, the green color or?
The color is silver.
Ah, okay. So, Erik, we are recording this on the 10th of November. I'm just guessing here, but did you enjoy going to Glasgow?
I didn't go this time. I've been to, I think, 10 different climate talks. I think there are some positive messages from Glasgow. I mean, India made some new commitments. There are agreements on deforestation and on methane. So there are some positives, but overall, I don't think climate diplomacy is the main action at the moment. The entire initiative has moved from climate diplomacy, from the diplomats to business. It's in the political economy. We now see the big changes. As an example, when President Xi Jinping of China promised that China will stop all overseas coal investments and put the entire force of the Chinese economy behind solar, wind, green hydrogen, it goes much, much, much more important than any outcome from Glasgow.
And remind me, so you didn't go to Glasgow and Xi Jinping also did not go?
He didn't go either, but that contrary to Western belief, it's due to COVID. You may portray it as good leadership because you do not want to go abroad as long as no Chinese basically can go abroad or no foreigner can go to China because of the strict COVID restrictions. I went there in November last year and I had to the 2 weeks in absolute strict quarantine in Shanghai. Everyone I met was dressed like a beekeeper and I basically had no human interaction for the 14 days. I served the food, Chinese or European food at my choice at the door, but I didn't touch or speak to anyone.
Doesn't sound like great fun. Now, if you had to pick one place to either live happily ever after and or... Who do you think is going to save our planet the most? China, India, European Union, or the USA?
It's a hard choice because I love all these four places, but I've always thought that afterlife was a bit boring. I mean, no religion has basically been able to describe afterlife in an attractive way. Living at a island somewhere with some virgins going around and some fruits in the trees is not really appealing to me. So I need a place of action. And there's one place of action, it's India. There is always something going in India. And added, you will have a lot of time to eat good food in afterlife. And Indian food is the best in my, at my taste.
Who is your favorite politician alive? Any country, but alive today, your favorite politician in the whole world?
Alive today, maybe Chancellor Merkel of Germany. She has been a very steady force. If you look to history, the person I admire more than anyone else is Abraham Lincoln, the American president. He had this combination of being absolute pragmatic in the means and absolutely principled in what he wanted to achieve. He wanted to bring America out of slavery and to keep America together. But there was no compromise he could not make with that under that aim.
Who is your favorite billionaire?
Bill Gates, of course, has turned his enormous money into good use after he left the day-to-day leadership of Microsoft. Elon Musk, it's hard not to admire what he has achieved with Tesla, making is basically from nothing, just by his own fantasy and ability to create, with, of course, lots of good people. So those are two.
If you had to pick someone from Norway that you like?
I'm a great admirer of Kjell Inge Røkke. He has some of the same abilities to see opportunities. I mean, he has been close to bankruptcy on a couple of occasions, but he always bounced back and always saw the opportunity to do something new.
I have a statement or a question statement. So-called ESG funds, ESG, of course, being partly environmental and social and governance. So these ESG funds that exclude, i.e. sell, everything they don't like, so including, for example, everything related to fossil fuels, as opposed to, you know, being an active owner and advocating for change, are you buyer or seller of these ESG funds?
It's much more important to invest in the positive because, I mean, if you go out of, say, oil or gas or whatever, there will always be someone else to pick up those stocks and you will not make a big difference. However, if you actively invest in the positive opportunities in solar, green hydrogen, wind, electric mobility, whatever it is, you are doing a lot of good to the world. And I have advocated this now for the last 10 years when it comes to the Norwegian Oil Fund, where all focus have been to get out of the bad, out of weapons, out of tobacco, out of oil. I mean, all that's good. But it's much, much more important if the oil fund could establish a huge business line in the new economy, or the green economy of the future.
One of the last questions. Do you have a life motto?
Not really. But
I saw you had one, or it was related to one of your previous web pages. It said, if we all come together and work together, there's no limits to what we can achieve on planet Earth. When you say that, do you then mean that you're not so keen to go to Mars?
I'm keen to explore space. Of course, we are just at the beginning of that. So we need to learn a lot more about space, about the Milky Way and, of course, the entire space. So I'm keen on that. But I fundamentally believe that we humans have created miracles before. We have overcome enormous difficulties. We forget, but as close back in history as 200 years ago, slavery was normal all over the planet. I mean, the priest said that it's in the Bible. The mullah said it's in the Quran. The economist said the British Empire will go down and under if we start getting out of slavery. And then some young people in London started picking the fight. Yes, they got support from much more powerful people like Lincoln in the United States. And today there's not one place on planet Earth where you can send the police to bring in your slave. And if you look to the more recent history, since 2000, we have halved global poverty, an enormous miracle for so many people. The average human is much better educated, in much better health, and at any point in human history, if you are so lucky that you are a young girl now born in South Korea, on average, you will be 90 years. Completely unthinkable in human history up to now. So let's focus on what we have achieved and build upon that, and of course, do a lot more.
I think that was a pretty good introduction. Obviously, very good questions for myself, if I may say so, but also some pretty good and optimistic answers there. I think speaking on behalf of my listeners, I can say that we got to know you a little bit better now, Eric, and your very positive spin on the global challenges. Let's start with a personal touch. I actually first met you in person at the Jotun Annual General Meeting in 2016. And I think Jotun is a fairly interesting example because it's a global paints company. And they actually have factories in, for example, Myanmar and Libya. And do you want to remind the audience a little bit, sort of some of the key messages that you have to, you know, any global company operating in, troublesome areas?
Yes, Jotun is a very impressive Norwegian company, in my view, a family-based company, which has basically been a dominant force in its sphere, which is quite remarkable. I remember we traveled around my family in Indonesia and went to a lot of very remote places in Indonesia. The only reminder we saw of Norway was...
the penguin.
Yeah, exactly. It was nothing else. And I firmly believe that companies like Jotun should try to stay on even in difficult places, because bringing prosperity to places will normally always also bring more democracy and better education, better health for people. It's a tragedy that Telenor decided to go out of Myanmar. Myanmar is now isolated, poor. In all likelihood, it will remain so for quite some time. It's fully understandable that Telenor decided that they needed to withdraw, but it would have been much, much better for the people of Myanmar if Telenor had remained, even if they had to face a number of difficulties, of course, with different demands from the military government. But it's not like withdrawing from Myanmar, isolating Myanmar, will make a change in Myanmar more likely. It may make it much less likely. It takes a much longer time. And we should do our utmost to invest and create the economic prosperity also in the difficult places. And without business like Jotun or Telenor and, of course, any number of other companies, we cannot achieve that.
So I want to touch a little bit more upon Myanmar, because I read that you were, when you were a minister for development or foreign development, you broke the ice, as it says, and you were one of the first Western minister who visited Myanmar in June 2010. And I believe it was pretty much as bad then as it is now. So this is sort of before and after.
Yeah, they said I was the first person west of New Delhi who went to Myanmar. But at that time, I met a number of European and American colleagues. All of them said boycotting, isolating Myanmar is wrong. It will not help. But none of them wanted to take the chance to do something, because they said that's just a political risk. I'll be criticized by media, I'll be criticized by civil society if I do it, so I don't want to do it, even if I believe it's the right thing to do. Jonas Gahr Støre and myself, we dared to do it, even if it was risky. And I think it paid off to contribute to the then military generals opening up. The generation of generals who did that around 2010 was an incredibly impressive group. They had been through long years of isolation and military dictatorship, but understood how backward Myanmar was compared to the two big neighbors, to China and to Thailand. It's an incredibly poor place where people are living in the absolute abrupt poverty, while, of course, the vast majority in both Thailand and China now belongs to the middle class. So they understood the need to change, and they started changing. Surprisingly, as it may be, these generals were in many ways more impressive than Aung San Suu Kyi, the long-term democracy advocate. She is very impressive in her stubbornness and her ability to keep up the good spirit under difficult circumstances. But she was not so impressive as a political leader when she became the supreme leader of Myanmar.
And if I may ask the obvious then, so you see the similarities between these ESG funds that exclude everything they don't like, and the politician that exclude going to countries they don't like, and exclude speaking to politicians they don't like?
I'm not sure it's exactly similar.
There is some similarity.
There is a good political statement to withdraw from, say, coal or oil. We need to change. But the way we will get out of our addiction to fossil fuels is, of course, to invest in the new. When the cars are electric, when we have solar and wind energy at scale, when we are developing offshore wind in Norway, when green hydrogen becomes the normal way of powering heavy vehicles, ships, maybe aircraft, well, then oil and gas will reduce in value by the day. Everyone understands that. And the most important way to get to that point is to invest very heavily and very determinedly in the new economy.
Great segue, because my next question was on that, because I introduced you a little bit as a sort of a Dr. Feelgood for green climate optimism, capitalism, but you do say, and Eric, you are a former left socialist, so you do want the government to be a very big part of the green shift that is being run by the companies.
Yeah, every environment market I know of is a regulated market, because environment markets do not start kind of spontaneously. I mean, you want to sell more mobile phones, you don't need any government regulations. But if you want to move heavily into offshore wind or into green hydrogen, you would need regulations from the government for the safety of this, maybe introductory offers, maybe government helping out of science. So basically all these markets are regulated. But within those regulations, of course, you need the enormous power which only business can bring to scale, to innovate, and to make solutions which can be applicable to the vast majority of people.
And so to make money, that obviously you need money for all these investments.
There is no known mechanism to make the green shift happen faster than if many people can make a lot of money for it or buy it. So that these some environmentalists have that is kind of morally inferior to make money from going green, it couldn't be more wrong.
I love this. Amen. But you are talking common sense, and you're talking to me, and obviously I work for a securities firm, but you have a lot of followers on your favorite social media, which I guess is...
Yeah, it's Twitter, but a lot of people tell me that Instagram is much more for the youth, and I'm now also starting on LinkedIn, so let's see how much I can manage.
What do you think what is the big change between your, what I think is common sense views and some of the, climate activists that are maybe a little bit more negative and always focusing on, the society needs to change into some sort of, we all need to, stop flying, stop eating meat, stop driving old cars. Everyone needs to change and nobody needs to make any money. That's a sort of stereotypical negative view that some people have of environmentalists, and you're very opposite. So how do we bridge that?
I think these guys largely remain in the 20th century, because it's true. I mean, after the Industrial Revolution, of course, there was a model for development all over the world. It started in the United Kingdom, then spread to Germany, to the United States, to Japan, to Korea, and finally to China. And that was, first you prioritize economic growth and economic development, and when you become rich after polluting like hell, you start taking down the pollution. And that was happening in London in the 1950s with the London smog, and that happened lately in all Western societies, and it's now happening large scale, big scale in China. But that's the old model, because the new model is, of course, that we can go green and develop at the same time. Solar energy is now the cheapest energy anywhere in the world. Solar energy in India is the cheapest energy which has ever existed on planet Earth. I mean, true, there are issues. You need to prepare the grid, because you need batteries, because the sun will not shine 24 hours. So there are issues. But by and large, we can base our future development on solar and wind and renewables. And we can move fast into electric mobility, and do green tourism, green agriculture, circular economy. All these are win-win-win propositions, triple win. You create jobs and prosperity, better for your health and your well-being, and better for Mother Earth at the same time. So we need to get out of this old thinking that either it's development or environment, now it's both.
And you said that if Norway puts as much effort as China, US, India, and EU on the green shift, the oil will be sort of phased out. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
I think it's very interesting that the two most powerful persons in the world, President Biden of the United States and President Xi Jinping of China, is completely on my way of talking here. President Xi has launched in China the slogan, green is gold. What does it mean? It's obvious. If you go green, you can create any number of jobs and prosperity, and you can make also China a big power in the world.
They like to make money in China.
Absolutely. They understand that. But they, of course, they have brought 1.4 billion people out of poverty. It's an amazing result. But many of the Chinese, while out of the extreme poverty, is of course still relatively poor and want rapid economic development. But exactly the same message in the United States. I have hardly ever heard President Biden speaking about the all the horrors of climate change, sea level rise or hurricanes or forest fires, all this. He's not speaking about that. He's speaking about all the opportunities for United States of America, creating a better society, creating jobs, and going green. And his green plan, which is now discussed in the American Congress, it's called America Jobs Plan. So this is the attitude we need to adopt, how to go green while create prosperity and economic growth at the same time.
That is, of course, interesting. In one country, you have politicians that need to be reelected, but in the other country, they don't really worry about reelections so much, but they worry about the happiness of the people in China. I think that's a big policy shift in China now, that common prosperity is the overruling goal of the society.
Absolutely. I mean, the Chinese leaders are not up for election, but they are very, very eager to listen to the view of the people. And the conversation I had repeatedly in China over the last 10 years was the following. I would say, I mean, you must be so happy. Look to this. I mean, China was so poor. First time I came to China, everyone lived in poverty. And now look to these amazing cities, which is the most modern in the world. And people said, yes, I'm very happy with this, but I want to see the sun. Uh-huh. Or I don't want my children to live in this hell of pollution.
Yeah.
And that message from the Chinese middle class was absorbed by the political leaders. They listened to it and understood it, and they started to change. And now, of course, pollution has come down in Chinese cities in an extremely fast manner.
So you have on your Twitter handle or Twitter feed handle that you are the president of the Green Belt and Road Institute. Now, that sounds like it's sponsored by China.
I'm not. in fact, sponsored by the United States of America, meaning that I'm working for World Resources Institute, which is an American institution. But true, I'm working very closely with China, because China has half of all solar energy in the world. It's the biggest by far on wind, on green hydrogen. 99% of all electric buses in the world are running on Chinese roads. And China, more and more, is also the best environment practice in the world. For instance, President Xi Jinping just promised that China will plant an amount of trees the size of the Kingdom of Belgium every year from now to 2030. So China has so much to offer. And of course, we want to take these to all the Chinese investments abroad, stop coal and focus on the renewables. And when China builds railroads or roads, make sure that there are bypasses so animals can survive and that they are fitting into the ecology. So it's so much to be achieved working with China, and we need to avoid this idea that the world should be separated in one American or one Chinese sphere. Let's use the old Indian slogan from 2,000, 3,000 years back, the whole world is one family.
Yeah, and just one step back here, in case we have any listeners who's been, you know, on the moon or on Mars and who didn't really follow the world news, but the Green Belt and Road Initiative, I guess if we just take one step back, and if you were required to describe the Green Belt and Road Initiative in your words.
Yeah, it's basically to revitalize the old Silk Road, which of course was the road to bring silk from China to Europe. It was at those days more difficult to find what we could produce, which the Chinese took an interest in, but I guess skins from beavers and bears were among the products we could take the other way. But basically, this was the connection between Europe and China.
So it's infrastructure.
It's about infrastructure, but it's also about people-to-people's contact, learn from each other. And it's now, I mean, while Europe and China was at the center of this, it's now, of course, focused on Africa, Latin America. Even a country like Chile, which is as far away from the Silk Road that you can ever get, is a core member of Belt and Road. 130 nations in the world are part of Belt and Road. United States is skeptical, India is skeptical, but nearly all others are with it.
In a weak moment, I Googled Belt and Road criticism, and there's quite a few things that come up. And sure. I just clicked on one of the editorial sort of right-leaning, but I respect Forbes magazines. So I just looked at what their main criticism was, and it's sort of, you know, quite... You know, comments. They say the Belt and Road seems to be everything that China does abroad and nothing at all. The vagueness makes it difficult for other countries and international to fully invest in it. This has been highlighted in a report by the European Union Chamber of Commerce. So, yeah, I guess some of the criticism goes to the fact that it's a little bit opaque, and so that it's easy to sort of fear that there's some more geopolitical power grab behind the whole initiative. But you don't seem to worried about that, Eric?
No, I'm not really worried with that. And I don't really respect the idea in the West that we should look to everything which is wrong or can go wrong in China, or for that matter in India. That when I go to China, I tell my Chinese friends, I mean, don't demonize the United States of America. It's a great, fantastic country. We in the West don't understand that there is a mirror image. I mean, nationalism is very strong in the United States and in Europe, but so it is in China. When China is criticized, they end up supporting the leaders and fighting back against the West. So let's build bridges. We need to work together. And at the core, Belt and Road is basically the same ideas as the American Marshall Help to Europe after the Second World War. Basically three reasons why China is doing this: to help others which are less fortunate than China, to project Chinese power and cultural influence and political contacts, and of course the understanding that Chinese industry can only thrive, they can only get market, they can only get raw materials if it's a prospering world. So there's nothing in this which is different from what we try to do in the West. But unfortunately at the moment, China is much, much better at investing in railroads and roads in the poorer part of the world than we are.
You also have on your Twitter handle that you are related to or focusing on or associated with Morrö Batteries, which is, of course, a company that Arctic has been advising, and they have raised money with Agder Energi and Gjelsten Holding and others. Briefly, what is Morrö?
This is a really exciting initiative. I mean, 3 years back, I guess no one thought Norway could develop a battery industry. The battery industry in the world is at the moment completely Chinese, or at least East Asian dominated. But when all European car companies are now going into the to electric mobility, because we need a large scale battery industry in Europe to provide for jobs, but also energy security and otherwise. And this is an amazing initiative from a number of people who have now brought together fantastic people from all over the world to develop a battery industry in Arendal. There are two other similar initiatives in Norway. But if this will create thousands of jobs in Arendal just in the Morrö factory, and many more thousands if you add delivering supplying industries, etc. So it'll be by far, without any competition, the biggest industrial adventure ever happening in the Agder of Norway.
And do you think it's a coincidence that it's Arendal? I mean, there is it's quite a story there with Sameide and the waterfalls and, I guess, proximity to the rest of Europe. And I'm not from Arendal. It may sound that way, but I'm from Kristiansand, which is obviously the greater city in the south. But Arendal seems to be onto something here.
Yeah, of course, there are relatively low prices of energy, which helps a battery factory. There is a good supply of well-educated and not so costly labor in Norway. I mean, we tend to believe that we are a high-cost country, but we are not necessarily a very high-cost country when it comes to engineering.
So.
Exactly. And of course, Arendal is close to the European market and, as you say, an industrial tradition. I think this is very exciting. I will do my best to support them and help them to succeed. And of course, this is the future. I mean, some people are asking, what shall we live from after oil? I think it's a completely wrong question. After oil, we should live from exactly the same we live from before and under oil. That's hard work and smart work.
Yeah, and natural resources can be in many different forms, right? I mean, the hydropower is a beautiful, clean energy natural resource that maybe we could exploit in even better terms.
Absolutely, but let's remind ourselves that we are an exception in Norway. We are one of the very few successful raw material-based economies in the world. The others I can think of is places like the United Arab Emirates, UAE, and they have been also very successful, but largely raw material-based economies. I mean, think of Venezuela or think of Nigeria has been fully unsuccessful in turning these into wealth. Most successful economies, however, South Korea, Singapore, Vietnam, China, they either have no raw materials at all, like Singapore or South Korea, or very limited raw material-based compared to the enormous economies, like, say, in the case of China. So hard work and smart work, that's how we will succeed in Norway in the decades and centuries to come.
And you did mention that there was one other battery factory, which I believe is in Mo i Rana, which is, and then I do believe that you had a I found a funny statement after the Norwegian elections in September. You said something about maybe there is a stereotype that a lot of the green voters are, you know, sipping cafe lattes in Grünerløkka, which at Sankthansheim, where you live.
Yes, that's
and I believe you had a comment about maybe that's not where the future of these green jobs are going to come, etc. And now a little bit that could be portrayed differently.
No, I mean, all the main jobs in the new green economy when it comes to green industry in Norway will come in what we call distriktene.
Mo i Rana.
Arendal. There is a third group led by Equinor and Hydro will also aim at establishing, and Panasonic, establishing a battery factory. But I'm very sure that factory will not be at Grünerløkka or Sankthansheim either. Of course, Aker is now investing heavily in Narvik. Again, so there's enormous opportunities for the rural areas of Norway from this. And I find it extremely irritating that the debate about the rural areas in Norway is so narrow, focused on the past. Much, much, much more important for business to get a high-quality 5G network than it is to get to stay with the post offices as they were in the past century. And there's so many fantastic opportunities in Norwegian rural areas which we should explore and create that optimism. We want people to move to the rural areas. You must create an optimism. Think of the fact that someone are experimenting with fish farms in open sea, but of course you will need land bases for those also. That's an enormous opportunity for northern part of Norway, for instance.
You mentioned Aker, and you did actually also mention Mr. Røkke. So what exactly is your level of cooperation with Mr. Røkke? Because there is if I Google you, there are some, question marks in the maybe not the most loving parts of the internet with you working for, a diehard capitalist ex-fisherman like Mr. Røkke.
I'm admiring him because, look to his biography. He was 15 or maybe 14 years when he was kicked out of school. The teacher told him that you are so stupid that the rest of the class cannot survive if they are like you. And then they went to Alaska, made a lot of money, and then they came back investing it in Norway. And there was enormous skepticism for very long. But he's proved that he's staying on, he's creating jobs, and he has this ability to always look for new opportunities. He doesn't need me in no way. He helped me when I came out of the UN, and the UN kicked me out because I didn't want anyone to try to reform this institution, which is so much in need for reform. So they kicked me out, and then Till Ingen came and said, let's have dinner together, let's discuss. And what I can do for him maybe sometimes is to provide some political advice as to how the Norwegian political system works or how the European Union or the global politics works. But he is not depending on my advice in any real sense.
The first thing that you looked to help him with was plastic recycling, was it, in Ghana?
Yes, he wanted to establish a pyrolysis factory in Ghana. We have made an enormous effort to figure out how that can be done. But so far, we have not been able to establish a model for that, which can in any way be commercial. And if it's not commercial, it will be very hard to replicate in other parts of the world. But we have not given up, we will look into whether Aker can do something on plastics in the future.
And then Aker Horizons is, of course, the holding company for all the sort of green ventures. You have mentioned a lot. You seem very positive on many of these aspects, wind, solar. Is it one area that you are mainly focusing on in your sort of advice to Aker Horizons? Is it carbon capture? Is that a big thing for you?
I have the biggest heart for offshore wind.
Offshore wind is your biggest...
Yeah, for a very clear reason. Every source of energy comes with difficulties. Large-scale solar, of course, needs huge areas. Those areas can hardly be where people are living. You won't find any in the, say, Yangtze Valley in China or the Ganges Valley in India. There are not any space for big-scale solar.
And hardly in Europe at all.
Exactly. No. So small-scale solar and rooftop solar, which we need to do a lot more in Norway. Just this summer I was traveling in Germany, and I hardly saw any roof of any farmhouse without solar. So
probably the same in California.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We need to do a lot more of that. But there, small-scale solar and offshore wind, in my view, are the two energy sources with hardly any negatives. There are very few birds out in the open sea.
I was going to ask about the birds.
Exactly. it's hardly thinkable that there will be any negative effect on fisheries. And of course, it's out of the view. No one will lose the good night's sleep because of this. So if we can develop floating offshore wind, it has an enormous potential to feed Europe and, of course, other parts of the world with green energy. So I think it's basically a matter of scale. When we quarreled in Copenhagen in 2009 about climate, the catastrophe, no one ever said, oh, in the next 10 years, the price of solar will be reduced by 90%. And it was not mainly reduced because of new innovations that also happened, but mainly because of scale.
Well, China wanted to make this a big...
They subsidized it, for sure. There was for sure new innovations. I mean, many of the original patents were from California or from Germany, and even from Norway.
Norway, exactly.
But China and India took it to such a scale that the price fell to 10%. Exactly the same, I believe, will happen with offshore wind. The day you start doing it at large scale, price will come down and it will be affordable. And we should really aim at that.
Difficult to ask my final question because it sounds like you already answered it a bit. But if you were young Erik Solheim today, I mean, we have, of course, both very old and experienced business leaders and also some students listening to this podcast. So what is your sort of key advice that you want to encourage the young listeners to do? Should we all go out and start an offshore wind farm each, or how do we best go along with this?
I think the best advice is on a different level. It's to be kind to people. Try to be kind to other human beings and they will reciprocate with kindness. Try to be curious on society and try to absorb this can-do spirit.
Optimism, can do.
We can achieve quite a lot together. And then you can go into business, onto politics, onto civil society groups, into your neighborhood, wherever you want to go. But as long as you're kind, curious, and optimistic, you will achieve quite a lot.
Fantastic end to a very energetic and lovely conversation with Erik, the Dr. Feelgood Climate Optimist. Thank you very much for participating in the Arctic Podcast, Erik.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast has been prepared by Arctic for information purposes only. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. The information provided in this podcast is not intended to constitute investment advice, nor is the information intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any financial instrument. Relevant and specific professional advice should always be obtained before making any investment or credit decision. It is important to note that past performance is not indicative of future results. This podcast does not fulfill the criteria for preparing investment research and must be seen as marketing material. All information submitted during this podcast is obtained from public sources that Arctic believes to be reliable, but which Arctic has not independently verified. Arctic makes no guarantee, representation, or warranty as to its accuracy or completeness. No liability whatsoever is accepted for any direct or indirect, including consequential, loss or expense arising from the use of information from this podcast.